Yes, it was certainly something. We punched so hard in episode one, it left your intellectual jaw completely scattered. But believe you me, with 10 rounds to go, each subsequent hit will make you stronger. It's like sharpening a blade on the whetstone, not like getting kicked by the same mule twice. Now, I gotta be honest with you, and it gives me no pleasure to say this, but Wes and Audrey have decided no further episodes will be recorded under the influence. In their words, the episodes are gonna be leaner, focused, but dangerous as ever. So even though you can't have enough of my unbearably handsome intellect, I shall not stand in the way of a good show. I'll let my dynamic deputies enthrall you with a breakdown of the updated SCIE reconstruction module. And yes, updated on purpose. This dossier is a living forensic instrument, not a frozen press release. Since episode one, the appendices have tightened, and some hard null results have positively narrowed what the architecture is allowed to look like. So all in all, the schematic just got sharper.
If you're trying to debug a massive electrical short in a skyscraper, you don't just stare at a burned out outlet on the 14th floor and call it a day.
Sure.
You have to trace the current back to the breaker, then out to the municipal grid. And sometimes you literally have to look at the severe geomagnetic storm happening outside in the atmosphere to understand what actually tripped the system in the first place.
That right there is the fundamental principle of forensic engineering. You've got to establish the correct boundary conditions. If you artificially restrict your view to just the room where the spark happened, you will misunderstand the mechanism of the failure.
You end up blaming a faulty wire when the actual cause was a massive surge from the macro environment. And that framework is what we're walking through today. This is an updated reconstruction follow-up to our original deep dive on the SCIE. That's the spatially constrained interferometric event. We're the armchair physicist, and we are co-authors of the dossier. Now, our lead author, Chris, already introduced this deep dive previously, so he won't be joining the discussion.
It's just us today.
We're bringing you directly into our workshop. We want to really open up the actual physics framework, the newly updated appendices, and the hard data constraints that we carry in our investigation.
We're going to walk you through our system-level closure path. We're going to map the entire grid of this event step by step. But to properly orient you to the architecture of this dossier, we have to establish a really strict evidentiary posture. We can't just jump straight into pointing at a map or naming a specific piece of hardware and claiming we've definitively solved it.
No, that's not how physics works.
Forensic physics requires us to separate our work into distinct, rigorous layers. If we blur these layers, we lose the scientific integrity of the analysis.
Because there's a massive difference between what the physical evidence demands and the working theory we build to try and explain it. So we break this down into four tiers.
Okay, so the first tier is the audit established burdens. This is strictly what the physical record demands. It's the ledger of energy, mass, and thermodynamics that absolutely has to balance.
Non-negotiable math.
Correct. And if the standard baseline model fails this audit, well, we carry a burden to explain why. Then the second tier is the surface mechanism signature. When we look at the verified anomalies across the physical record, they aren't just a random collection of weird events. They form recurring phenotypes that point to a very specific class of physics. Now, just so we're totally grounded here, Tier 1 is basically what is broken with the official story. And Tier 2 is the shape of the hole left behind, like the clues telling us what tool actually did the breaking.
That is a highly accurate way to frame it, the hole left behind.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And third, the reconstruction path attempts to close the loop, to build a functioning physical system that satisfies those exact signatures.
Got it. And the last one?
Finally, Tier 4. The active engineering validation lanes. These are the open questions, the mathematical parameters we are actively working to tighten.
I really want to spend some serious time on that first tier, the audit burdens, because we talk a lot about the energy gap, specifically regarding the comminution of materials.
The comminution burdens.
And for the listener, comminution is just the physical reduction of a solid into smaller particles. So we are talking about hundreds of thousands of tons of structural concrete turning into fine micron scale dust. So walk me through the actual math there. Why can't gravity do that?
The best way to look at gravity is as a fixed, closed thermodynamic budget.
Okay, a closed budget.
The total available energy in a falling building is just its gravitational potential energy. The formula is simply mass times gravity times height.
So you can calculate the exact number of joules.
Yes, you can calculate the exact amount of joules available if the entire structure drops all the way to the bedrock.
So there's a hard ceiling on how much work the falling building can actually do to itself.
A mathematically absolute ceiling. There's no more energy than that. Now, we must calculate the work of comminution required to turn that specific volume of solid concrete into a fine, flower-like aerosol.
And that takes a lot of energy.
A massive injection of energy. Creating fracture surfaces requires work. When you audit the physics, the energy required to drive that rapid macroscopic aerosolization to achieve the micron-scale particle distribution that was observed at the site, it is orders of magnitude higher than what gravity can mathematically fund.
Let me try to put that into a street-level perspective, because I was trying to explain this to a friend recently. I said, look, think about the energy it takes you to take a sledgehammer and smash a single solid concrete cinder block into four chunks.
Right. It takes a solid swing.
A really hard swing. Now, imagine the energy required to take that exact same cinder block and grind it down until it is as fine as powdered sugar.
It's immense.
You'd need, like, industrial grinding machines running for hours, right? But gravity is basically just dropping the cinder block from a height. It might break into a few pieces, but it cannot turn itself into powdered sugar just by falling.
No. And when you multiply that cinder block by 500,000 tons of structural concrete, well, the energy deficit becomes astronomical.
The numbers just don't work.
They don't.
The standard gravity model fails the audit. The energy to creating fracture surfaces had to come from outside the closed gravitational system. The system must be thermodynamically open.
But what about critics that say comminution is already accounted for under a Besant-style collapse math?
Well, that claim mostly maps to the settled coarse fraction found on site afterwards, not the suspended ultrafine and nanoscale fraction that remained airborne and dispersed downwind.
Right. So our retort is scope. It's the wrong slice of the particle distribution. It does not by itself close the finer suspended fraction or downwind export away from the site.
And if those fractions stay in play, the full comminution burden continues to stay open.
Which naturally leads us to the second massive audit burden, the seismic data. This is another area where the official narrative just fractures when you look at the telemetry. Because, I mean, if you drop a massive, highly coherent structure to the ground, what should a seismograph read?
Well, you should see a massive ground-coupled impulse, a huge spike. You have hundreds of thousands of tons of mass accelerating toward the Earth. When it hits, that momentum transfers directly into the bedrock.
But that is not what the telemetry shows at all, is it?
Not even close. The seismic telemetry for the destruction of the towers shows a local magnitude of roughly 2.3. And for Building 7, the event barely registered a 0.6 local magnitude.
2.3. That's a mild earthquake you might not even feel a few miles away.
It's incredibly low.
How is that physically possible if a massive building is supposedly hitting the ground at free fall speed?
The low magnitude tells us a profound physical truth. It was a suppressed ground-coupled impulse. It was not a standard macroscopic impact. The momentum was decoupled from the bedrock.
See, I need to challenge that phrase for a second. Momentum was decoupled. Because that sounds almost magical, right? Mass has momentum. It has to go somewhere. How does a building just decouple from the ground beneath it?
Well, it happens when the mass ceases to be a coherent, solid object before it reaches the ground. If the structure is undergoing that rapid macroscopic aerosolization we just discussed, if it is being converted into a dust suspension in midair, it no longer falls like a sledgehammer.
It falls like dust.
It settles like a dense fog. The mass is still there, yes, but the kinetic coupling to the bedrock is diffused and suppressed. So the seismic silence reinforces the midair comminution.
Yes. Okay, so the standard model fails the energy audit, and it fails the seismic record. That pushes us into the shape of the hole left behind.
Right.
When we look at the dossier docs detailing the damage, we see specific bounded geometry. We're talking about clean, planar cuts through heavy materials.
Very clean boundaries.
Yeah, we see these vertical voids running down through structures that look like someone took a massive, invisible apple corer to the building. And most importantly, we see material selective coupling.
The material selectivity is perhaps the most glaring deviation from the standard model. Because gravity and hydrocarbon fires are indiscriminate mechanisms. They're a broad spectrum. A fire will burn anything combustible in its proximity, and gravity will crush anything underneath it, regardless of what it's made of.
Yeah, fire doesn't choose what to burn.
But the forensic record details damage that is highly selective, based specifically on the electrical properties of the materials.
We're talking about properties like conductivity, permittivity, and impedance.
Correct. We see immense thermal deformation of heavy structural steel sitting right next to unburned paper. We see complete dissociation of concrete right next to surviving plastics. The destruction cared about what class of material it was interacting with.
So, if the standard model of a gravity collapse and an office fire is just a clumsy hammer that smashes everything equally, we are actually looking at a damage footprint left by a scalpel.
A very precise scalpel.
And not just any scalpel, but one that can somehow distinguish between tissue and metal. We have to build a blueprint for that scalpel.
That blueprint is the required reconstruction. The standard model failed the engineering audit. The selectivity and the geometric precision force us to reconstruct a field-mediated, spatially localizable pathway. We have no other choice but to reconstruct the physics.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because we're moving into the core teaching block of this entire deep dive. We're going to map out the SEIE architecture. Because if you need a field-mediated scalpel that can slice through steel and powderize concrete, you need a way to power it, shape it, and target it without blowing up the entire eastern seaboard in the process.
Right. And we must start with the atmosphere itself. The carried working architecture requires a very specific dielectric precondition.
Okay, lay the groundwork for us.
Overnight, leading into the morning of the event window, a sharp subsidence inversion formed over the New York City air column. Meteorologically, this is known as a severe clear condition.
Let me stop you right there. A subsidence inversion. What does that actually mean for the layman? Like, if I'm standing on the street in Manhattan that morning, looking up at the sky, what am I seeing? And why does a clear blue sky matter so much for an electromagnetic event?
Visually, you see a crisp, cloudless blue sky.
Just a perfect day.
A perfect day. But physically, what is happening is that a layer of warm air is sitting on top of a layer of cooler air near the surface, acting like a lid. In atmospheric physics, this severe clear condition acts as a robust dielectric cap.
A cap? Meaning it keeps things from leaking out?
It suppresses premature atmospheric discharge. If a system is attempting to load a massive amount of regional electromagnetic energy into a specific local geometry, well, the greatest risk is uncontrolled breakdown.
Right, you just get lightning.
Yes. You do not want the energy arcing randomly into the upper atmosphere or sparking off like a chaotic lightning storm. The subsidence inversion stabilizes the local dielectric environment.
So it holds the charge.
It allows the electrical potential to load and concentrate without short-circuiting prematurely.
Yeah.
It is a required boundary condition for the architecture to function.
It's literally the insulation on the planetary wire.
That makes sense. Mm. It's like heavily insulating a wire before you pump a high voltage current through it. And building that kind of potential requires a massive reservoir of energy. In our dossier, we point to the solar high-speed stream.
HSS?
Yeah. This high-speed stream of solar wind began impacting the Earth's magnetosphere around 7 a.m. EDT, which is 11 UTC.
Now, when people hear about solar events, their minds immediately go to science fiction. Let's be explicitly clear about our claim strength here. We are not suggesting the sun shot a targeted, coherent beam of plasma directly at lower Manhattan.
Oh, absolutely not. That's a fundamental misunderstanding of magnetosphere-ionosphere forcing. A high-speed stream is a flow of highly energetic charged particles from the sun. When this stream interacts with the Earth's magnetic field, particularly when the interplanetary magnetic field, the IMF, has a southward pointing component known as a negative B's orientation, it enhances magnetic reconnection.
And that does what exactly?
It allows the kinetic energy of the solar wind to couple highly efficiently into the Earth's magnetosphere.
So it's basically charging the entire upper atmosphere. It's a global forcing regime.
Yes. It provides a global forcing context. However, it's not a direct site-delivered beam of energy.
It's kind of like a municipality turning on the main breaker at a massive hydroelectric dam. The power is now surging through the high-voltage transmission grid, but you still need a local substation and a closed circuit to actually draw that power down into a specific neighborhood.
That is a very apt analysis. So we have the reservoir pressurized by the HSS. We have the local atmosphere cap provided by the severe clear inversion. Now we need a timing marker. The dossier docs point to the GEMA soft gate.
Correct. Around 8:20 a.m., magnetometer arrays stationed in Alaska, specifically the Geophysical Institute Magnetometer Array, or GEMA chain, recorded a coherent excursion.
In Alaska?
Yes. Within our reconstruction, we treat this anomaly as a critical sequence marker. It is a soft gate, indicating a fundamental change in the global current system.
Hold on, I need to push back on this a little.
Sure.
You are looking at a magnetometer in Alaska, which is thousands of miles away, to explain a timing sequence in New York. How does that work? And what is a magnetometer actually measuring anyway?
Good question. A magnetometer measures variations in the Earth's magnetic field. Because the ionospheric current systems are fundamentally global, a massive perturbation or loading sequence in one part of the Northern Hemisphere's grid will reflect as a current system shift elsewhere, especially in highly sensitive auroral arrays like KEMA.
So it's literally like a pressure gauge on a vast interconnected plumbing system.
It marks the transition into a systemic loading or charging interval. But again, we must calibrate our claims here.
Right, tier four rules.
Yeah, that's spot on. This is not a calorimetric measurement. The GIMA excursion does not mean we can look at the graph and calculate the exact joules hitting the site in Manhattan at 8:20 a.m. It's a timing handle. It shows the broader system actively entering a highly energized, activated regime.
The system is waking up. Okay, so we have the reservoir, the cap, the timing marker, and now we have to talk about Hurricane Erin.
Yes, we do.
Because I know there is an immense amount of wild speculation out there on the internet regarding this storm, so let's be extremely painstakingly clear about what our dossier actually carries. Erin is not a weather weapon. It is not a battery shooting energy at the city.
I cannot state this strongly enough. Hurricane Erin is not a direct energy source, nor is it a steered weapon in our model. It is carried in the reconstruction specifically as an atmospheric component that near stalled off the Atlantic coast. Its critical role is providing a stabilized geometry and a refractive boundary.
Okay, let me play the skeptic here for a minute.
Go ahead.
A massive hurricane just happens to stall off the coast on the exact morning all these other boundary conditions line up. I mean, that sounds like a massive, almost unbelievable coincidence. How does the dossier justify that this isn't just random weather, or conversely, someone intentionally steering a storm?
Well, the dossier does not attempt to assign intent to the meteorology. We look at it functionally. Whether it stalled naturally or was somehow influenced is completely outside the Tier 3 reconstruction. What matters is the physical function it provided while sitting there. A hurricane is a massive, organized dielectric and impedance structure in the atmosphere.
Okay.
By near stalling, it provided a massive fixed anchor for the electromagnetic geometry. It served as a propagation shaping medium.
Unpack propagation shaping medium for me. How does a storm shape a field?
High-frequency electromagnetic waves interact with the ionosphere and the troposphere. When you have a massive structured storm cell with intense ionization and steep atmospheric density gradients, it acts as a refractive boundary.
Like it bends the waves.
It shapes how the fields propagate over the horizon, bouncing and channeling the energy.
So it's essentially acting like a giant atmospheric lens, or like a mirror sitting where it needs to be off the coast to help focus or bounce the regional signal toward the target area.
A refractive and impedance boundary, yes. It stabilized the playing field. Without the near stall of Erin providing that companion path boundary, the spatial confinement of the energy over the target site would have been harder to maintain.
Let's bring this down from the atmosphere to the ground level, the targets themselves. The Twin Towers.
Yes.
In this SCIU architecture, they aren't just passive buildings waiting to be acted upon, are they? They're active components of the circuit.
Yes. They operated as incredibly massive, elevated conductive couplers. If you look at their construction, hundreds of thousands of tons of continuous, highly conductive structural steel reaching high into the sky. They acted as massive, monopole-like load structures.
So they were pulling the energy.
They essentially drew the field-driven work into themselves, acting as the terminal loads for the regional potential.
They were the antennas pulling down the charge. But every basic physics class teaches that a circuit needs a return path. Energy has to flow through a load and find ground. What served as the return path for an energy transfer of this unbelievable magnitude?
The Manhattan bedrock and the specific geometry of the WTC sub-basement slurry wall provided that circuit return path.
The slurry wall.
Yes. The slurry wall was a massive reinforced concrete structure deeply coupled to the wet soil and the water table.
Which actually provides a rational physics explanation for one of the biggest mysteries of the aftermath.
Yes.
Because after the towers came down, engineers worried the bathtub, that massive slurry wall holding back the Hudson River, was going to fail and flood the lower Manhattan subway system. But it survived almost entirely intact, even while the massive towers above it literally turned to dust. How did it survive?
It survived because of basic circuit logic. In any high-energy electrical system, the current does its destructive work in the high-impedance load. In this localized circuit, the high-impedance loads were the massive steel lattices of the towers. The current does not destroy the low-impedance ground reference.
The slurry wall was coupled to the wet, highly conductive earth, so it acted as the ground wire.
Yes. You destroy the resistor, the filament in the light bulb.
Yeah.
You do not destroy the thick copper ground wire leading into the earth. The slurry wall facilitated the massive current flow without bearing the brunt of the destructive impedance heating.
Okay, we have established the power reservoir, the atmospheric cap, the refractive lens of the storm, and the towers acting as grounded antennas. But we still have a major conceptual hurdle here. How do you get those clean, planar cuts and vertical voids we discussed earlier? Because if you just dump energy into a tower, it should just heat up uniformly or blow apart chaotically, right? That brings us to the invisible tripod.
It does. The reconstruction demands three specific vector roles to achieve what we call interferometric localization. This is how you create the scalpel. If you just blast a single uniform electromagnetic field from the ionosphere, it is largely isotropic. It just scatters and diffuses everywhere. To generate the sharp, defined damage boundaries, those knife-edge cuts, you need intersecting fields that only reach destructive energy thresholds precisely where they cross in three-dimensional space.
The best analogy I've heard for this is throwing two stones into a calm pond.
That's a classic one.
Yeah, each stone creates expanding ripples, and where the ripples from the left stone cross the ripples from the right stone, the water wave briefly spikes to twice the height. That crossing point is the node. But in this case, we're doing it in three dimensions with electromagnetic waves.
The pond analogy is highly effective. In our dossier, the tripod consists of three intersecting components. Component A, which we refer to as the anvil.
The anvil.
This is the companion path propagating from the Aran sector off the coast. It is a broad wave carrier signal that has been shaped and channeled by the hurricane's boundary.
So the anvil is coming in from the southeast. Then we have component B, the shear. This is a direct path coming from the east northeast, or the ENE vector.
Correct. And our dossier docs mentioned Brookhaven National Laboratory, or BNL, as a candidate facility located along this ENE vector.
Okay, I need to flag this heavily for the listener, sticking strictly to our Tier 4 rules.
We must be clear here.
We are keeping this attribution strictly conditional. We are absolutely not saying BNL fired a weapon and took down the towers. We are saying that an installation possessing BNL's specific heavy ion and high frequency infrastructure located in that geographic sector physically fits the stringent mathematical parameters required by the geometry.
That is the crucial distinction between a candidate attribution and a settled site claim. As physicists auditing the data, what matters to us is the mathematical vector, not the political attribution. Furthermore, we must clarify the role of this ENE signal.
Sure. What is it actually doing?
The high frequency, or HF, signal arriving from this vector acts as a modulating clock or a shear roll.
It provides the timing. It creates the interference pattern against the anvil. It is not the massive energy reservoir itself. It's like the conductor of the orchestra, not the muscle moving the instruments.
Correct. It defines the geometry of the destructive nodes. But an anvil and a shear crossing on an X and Y axis only give you a two-dimensional grid. To control the depth, to stop the energy from bleeding upward into the sky or randomly downward, you need a third dimension.
Component C, the hammer.
The hammer is a vertical stabilizing Z-pin. It provides the Z-axis spatial confinement. Our dossier carries an airborne or satellite class candidate family for this vertical role. But again, that remains firmly conditional. We do not have a specific tail number or orbital designation. What the physics firmly require is a vertical pinning component to trap the intersecting nodes where they need to be over the target structures.
So when these three invisible fields, the anvil from the ocean, the shear from the northeast, and the hammer from above intersect over lower Manhattan, they create these three-dimensional interferometric nodes.
Yes.
And inside those invisible boxes, the energy density suddenly crosses a catastrophic threshold, resulting in the material selective coupling. If you are standing outside the node, or if your material doesn't resonate with that specific frequency, you survive. Which is how you get a piece of flimsy paper fluttering into the ground unburnt right next to a steel column that has been subjected to immense thermal yielding.
That intersection, the localized node, is the fundamental essence of the SCIE architecture. Based on the rigorous audit of the Tier 1 burdens, it remains the carried reconstruction path to satisfy the geometric precision and the bizarre material selectivity we observe in the forensic record.
Okay, we have built the regional grid. We have the tripod. But as a listener, I am sitting here thinking of a glaring physical problem.
Which is?
How does this massive amount of energy actually bridge the gap from the elevated ionosphere way up there all the way down to the surface level without totally incinerating the miles of atmosphere in between?
That question forms the core of our lower atmosphere bridge validation lane. Our dossier docs frame this connection as a highly staged function. It is not a single, continuous, brute force lightning bolt from space. If it were, it would leave a massive thermal signature across the sky. The bridge happens in discrete, physics-driven stages.
Walk me through those stages.
First, you have pre-bias and threshold lowering. The regional induction we discussed earlier sets up a favorable electrical environment in the local air column, slowly lowering the dielectric resistance.
It's prepping the air, stretching the rubber band before it snaps.
Second is localized onset. Because the towers are acting as massive elevated conductive couplers, the electrical fields concentrate at their peaks. You begin to get avalanche or corona-like microphysics, creating the very first localized conductive pockets in the air immediately surrounding the target.
Like the static hum and glow you sometimes see around heavy power lines on a damp night, but on a massive scale.
Yeah, that's spot on. The third stage is capture and handoff. The developing atmospheric bridge physically connects with and hands off the energy into the tower infrastructure itself. At this point, the towers fully take over the concentration work.
They become the main conduit.
And the final stage is sustainment. The lower atmosphere bridge no longer needs to punch through the air. It merely maintains the boundary conditions, while the towers serve as the primary conduit carrying the systemic load.
This staged, stealthy approach is absolutely crucial because the dossier docs highlight some very specific null constraints. We looked at the GPS total electron content maps and the Millstone Hill Ionosonde data from that specific morning.
Yes, the data is very clear.
And those instruments showed no bulk overhead heating in the New York City region.
Which serves as a massive non-negotiable boundary condition for our model. It means we cannot lazily claim that a giant invisible heat ray was blasted over the city from a satellite in the ionosphere.
Right.
If a bulk thermal heating event of that magnitude had occurred in the upper atmosphere, those specific instruments would have recorded a blinding thermal signature. They recorded nulls.
So these nulls are actually incredibly helpful to us as investigators. They narrow the admissible mechanism space. It forces our reconstruction to be a non-heater, highly localized, geometry-dependent picture.
The lack of a broad thermal signature overhead dictates that the delivery mechanism had to be highly stealthy, extremely localized, or operating below the physical detection thresholds of bulk thermal sensors. It reinforces the necessity of the staged localized bridge concept over a brute force energy dump.
That brings us back down to the physical damage footprint itself, specifically the bounded damage geometry. We see vertical cylindrical voids cored through Building 6. We see clean planar cuts through the heavy structure of Building 4.
The geometric precision.
Yeah. I know we talked about the tripod, but how does the actual math of the intersecting fields explain the physical size and shape of this damage?
This is where our geometric module provides strict, falsifiable logic. We look at the physical map and the crossing angle between our two primary XY propagation vectors. The ENE direct path proxy bearing sits at 79.3 degrees from true north.
Okay, 79.3 degrees.
The Aaron sector proxy companion path bearing sits at 149.7 degrees. If you subtract the two, the primary crossing angle is exactly 70.4 degrees.
Okay, I have my protractor out, 70.4 degrees. Why does that specific angle matter to the physics of destruction?
Because in the physics of interferometry, the crossing angle of the waves, combined with the physical spacing of the resulting damage boundaries on the ground, allows you to mathematically reverse calculate the required operational frequency of the waves.
That is fascinating. So you measure the size of the hole, you look at the angle the waves crossed at, and that tells you the color or frequency of the invisible light that made the hole.
That is a highly effective way to visualize it. When we map that 70.4 degree crossing angle against the physical dimensions of the damage features, for example, the roughly 100 meter knife edge boundary that sheared Building 4, or the 25 to 30 meter subaperture void cored into WTC 6, the interferometric math points directly to a very specific high frequency band.
Between 2.6 and 10 megahertz?
Precisely in that band. The geometric constraints of the physical damage on the map dictate the operational frequency of the interference grid. We did not guess this frequency. It is mathematically derived from the geodetic bearings and the architectural scale of the physical destruction.
And the math gets even more specific when we look at the orientation logic, doesn't it?
It does. If you take the bisector of those two primary bearings, meaning the line halfway between the 79.3 degree shear and the 149.7 degree anvil, you arrive at an angle of 114.5 degrees.
Okay, 114.5 degrees. What does that line up with on the ground?
Well, the Twin Towers and the broader WTC complex were not built perfectly aligned to true north-south. The complex was rotated slightly on the grid. The east-west orientation of the major building faces sits at exactly 119 degrees.
Let me do the math. The mathematical bisector of our invisible energy field is 114.5 degrees, and the physical building face is sitting at 119 degrees. That is a difference of only 4.5 degrees.
The alignment is incredibly tight. The physics of interferometry dictate that the predicted fringe node lines, the boundaries where coupling peaks, will run parallel to that bisector. Therefore, the model predicts destructive boundaries running almost parallel to the physical building faces. This elegantly predicts the deeply anomalous east-west oriented damage boundaries seen in the dossier docs, such as the clean bisection of Building 3.
It's like the grid was tailored to the architectural layout. But we have to responsibly emphasize to the listener, while these are immensely powerful mathematical correlations, our dossier categorizes them as weaker versus stronger map level claims.
Yes, they remain conditional.
They remain strictly conditional and falsifiable tests within Tier 4. If someone runs a massive spatial correlation test against all the damage across the entire site and it doesn't fit the grid better than random chance, the map level claim fails. We aren't locking it in as religious dogma.
That is the necessary discipline of the audit. The math is highly compelling and predictive, but it is an active validation lane. It is not a closed case.
So we have built the regional grid, we have mapped the atmospheric bridge, and we have mathematically defined the geometry of the scalpel. Now let's look at what actually happened inside those invisible destructive nodes. The material response by class.
Once you have these geometric nodes filled with immense electromagnetic energy, how did the energy actually interact with the physical matter inside those nodes?
This is where the physics gets weird, but fascinating. Because if a building is destroyed by gravity or a normal office fire, everything burns or crushes roughly the same way. The heat transfer is diffusive, it spreads out. But here, we see materials acting as if they are obeying entirely different laws of physics. Let's talk about the conductors first, the metals.
For conductive materials, our working model points to conductive loop coupling, or CLC, and selective impedance heating, SIH. When you have a time-varying electromagnetic field, it induces high current densities within closed conductive geometries.
Let me translate that. If you put a piece of metal in a microwave, it sparks and heats up incredibly fast because the microwaves induce an electric current in the metal. The field is essentially pushing the electrons around so violently that it creates intense heat.
Correct.
So a conductive loop could be the steel frame of a vehicle or even the reflective metal loops on a firefighter's personal protective equipment.
Yes. This induced current leads to massive localized Joule heating. The field heats the metal from the inside, not the air around it. That is why metal on cars on surrounding streets could rust and heat violently, while paper right next to those cars did not ignite.
Because the paper is a dielectric.
Yes, it doesn't conduct electricity, it doesn't form a conductive loop, so it doesn't couple to the electromagnetic field in the same way. The field basically ignores the paper and cooks the metal.
That explains the weird fire behavior. And the structural steel of the towers?
For the heavy structural steel, we carry interferometric molecular dissociation, or IMD, for lattice decohesion, that is, field-driven bond failure and section loss.
Lattice decohesion.
Correct. The steel loses structural integrity without requiring a broad environmental furnace effect that would have cooked the entire city block. Where resonance-specific conditions are argued, ECR regime coupling handles the oxidation side. That means rapid oxidation and passivation failure. It is not the primary lattice loss path.
And what about the thermoplasticity? Because we have these bizarre forensic photos of massive pieces of structural steel that are rolled up like carpets. You can't do that with a normal fire without cracking the steel or seeing obvious signs of high temperature creep. It looks like it turned to butter, rolled up, and then instantly froze back into solid steel.
We explain that as athermal plasticity. That is what we call field-mediated softening. Blaha-type dislocation unpinning is our closest analog.
Yeah.
Remember, athermal means without heat.
The intense electromagnetic fields and low-frequency vibrations suppress the yield strength of the metal at the molecular level. It allows what we call dislocation unpinning. In plain English, the internal structure of the steel relaxes, meaning it can bend and curl plastically at much lower physical stresses without any bulk melting occurring.
Okay, that covers the metals. What about the dielectrics? The millions of tons of concrete, the glass, the ceramics. As we discussed in the energy gap, they didn't just break into smaller rocks, they turned into a massive micron-scale dust cloud. How does an electromagnetic field do that?
Because structural concrete is an electrical insulator, it does not conduct electricity like the steel lattices do. Therefore, instead of heating up or yielding plastically, it experiences what the dossier formally models as Coulomb-type fragmentation, which is an extreme form of dielectric saturation. IMD is the steel and mixed material branch. Coulomb is the dielectric branch.
Okay, Coulomb-type fragmentation. Break that down for me. What is actually happening to a 10-ton chunk of concrete at the microscopic level inside one of these nodes?
Think of the structural concrete as a rigid sponge. But instead of soaking up water, it is being forced to soak up an incredibly intense electrical charge from these intersecting energy fields. Because concrete is an insulator, that electrical charge cannot flow freely through it like it would in a copper wire. It has nowhere to go.
So it just gets stuck inside.
Yes. So the charge simply builds up and builds up.
Like aggressively rubbing a balloon on your hair to build static, but on a catastrophic, localized scale.
The concept is identical. It is dielectric saturation. Eventually, the electrical charge packed inside the rigid structure of the concrete becomes so impossibly intense that the positive and negative atomic charges inside the molecules themselves violently repel each other.
So the repulsive force between the atoms actually exceeds the physical glue, the binding energy holding the concrete together.
Correct.
The concrete doesn't just fracture along a fault line. Its internal bonds and interfaces fail. The material transitions from a solid, macroscopic state to a fine microscopic aerosolized dust.
That makes sense.
It is pulverization from the inside out, driven purely by electrostatic forces, not by the mechanical crushing of gravity.
Which answers the massive energy gap we talked about at the very beginning. Gravity couldn't crush the concrete that finely, but dielectric saturation for the concrete and IMD for steel and mixed fines are the mechanism branches we use to account for that work.
It closes the loop. We also have to talk about the body force effects. When we audited the physical aftermath, we found flipped and laterally displaced vehicles. We're talking about heavy cars that were picked up and moved significant distances without a corresponding blast crater or heat signature underneath them.
A major anomaly.
How does an electrical field pick up a car?
We explain this entirely through DEP, or dielectrophoresis, body force effects. Dielectrophoresis is a phenomenon where a physical body force is exerted on polarizable matter when it is sitting in a highly non-uniform, high-gradient electric field.
Explain that like I'm five. How does a non-uniform field create lift?
Think of static electricity picking up a piece of paper, but scaled up to industrial electromagnetic proportions. When an electric field is non-uniform, meaning it is stronger on one side of the car than the other, it creates a gradient. The metal of the car polarizes.
Right, the charge is separate.
And the stronger side of the field pulls on the polarized charges harder than the weaker side pushes them away. The net result is a literal physical body force that can lift or pull the object laterally. We strictly reject wind or conventional explosive blast waves as sufficient explanations for these lateral lifts and flips.
Because a blast wave leaves a thermodynamic signature. It shatters glass dynamically, it leaves a pressure crater, it burns the surrounding area.
It does. Conventional blast waves leave entirely different aerodynamic and thermal signatures. DEP explains the selective, localized lifting and flipping without the required overpressure of a chemical explosion.
So we have the setup, we have the interferometric geometry, and we have the highly specific material responses. Let's pull back and walk through the chronology of how this actually unfolded on the timeline.
The timeline of how this SCI event actually unfolded over the city. And I want to explicitly state, loud and clear, that this chronology is carried event logic. It is not a demonstrated, magically settled script. It's our best working system-level model based on the strict Tier 1 constraints.
Right, it's a carried model.
Walk us through how this sequence actually plays out from the morning of the event.
We conceptually divide the event into phases. We begin with phase one, the setup. This occurred quietly overnight leading into the morning window. the sharp atmospheric subsidence inversion fully formed, creating the essential dielectric severe clear condition over the city.
So the cap is on.
Yes. Simultaneously, Hurricane Erin near stalled offshore, firmly anchoring the required refractive propagation geometry.
The board is set, then we move into phase 2 and 3, the loading. We mark the timeline. Around 7 a.m., the solar high-speed stream forcing context arrives on the magnetosphere. The global forcing context is significantly elevated.
Following that, at 8:20 a.m., the GEMA magnetometer excursion provides our sequence Softgate. This marks the transition of the system into the local charging interval. The regional environment, shaped by the lens of Erin, begins to heavily load the massive elevated electrodes, the towers.
The invisible fields are intensifying, but the severe clear cap holds. It prevents early arcing. Then phase 4, the discharge interval. From roughly 8:46 a.m. to 10:28 a.m.
This is the active catastrophic interferometry window. The anvil, the shear, and the hammer intersect over the target coordinates. The structures cross the critical coupling thresholds.
This is when it happens.
Inside those localized three-dimensional nodes, we see the rapid aerosolization of the concrete via IMD, the thermal plasticity of the steel in the Blaha effect regime, ECR regime effects on the steel oxidation side, and the conductive loop heating in surrounding vehicles.
And then we reach phase 5 and 6, the shaping and aftermath. At 10:28 a.m., the North Tower, the final primary electrode, is completely destroyed.
That terminal destruction represents a massive site-level load loss. The primary electrode of the circuit is suddenly gone. The local circuit loses its main impedance network. While the broader geomagnetic system continues to evolve globally, the intense, localized interferometric coupling at the Manhattan site is effectively terminated.
But wait, what about Building 7? It didn't terminate until 5:21 p.m., hours after the main circuit was broken. How does the architecture account for that?
Building 7 is modeled as delayed side lobe exposure. Its destruction remains under validation.
Side lobe exposure?
Yes. It wasn't the primary target of the focal nodes, but because of its proximity, it sat bathed in the intense erratic fringe fields for hours during the primary discharge interval. It suffered immense cumulative lattice fatigue. It absorbed induced currents and suffered ionization hysteresis. The structure was slowly, fundamentally degraded over hours until it could simply no longer support its own gravity, resulting in a delayed, highly uniform structural failure.
Before we close out this timeline, we need to briefly, but importantly, mention those active engineering validation lanes you brought up at the very start of the show. We have several crucial, highly active validation lanes. First, the lower atmosphere localization and capture sequence. We are still modeling and tightening the exact field strengths and handoff efficiencies required to maintain that bridge.
Okay, what else?
Second, the link budget and fringe contrast. We are rigorously validating that the power available in the proposed interference geometry mathematically meets the massive comminution requirements at the primary nodes.
So proving the math can actually do the work.
Yes. Third, the FAC-linked or field-aligned, current-linked, high-frequency broadwave contribution. We are still validating the exact modulation physics of component A. And fourth, the overall control and coherence architecture.
How it all stayed locked in.
We are modeling how the system maintained phase lock and structural coherence despite natural atmospheric drift. We mark all of these clearly as ongoing Tier 4 evaluations. They are active engineering problems, not endpoints, or fatal failures of the reconstruction model.
The audit burdens carry the existence of the SCIE architecture. The validation lanes just refine its schematic.
That is the exact correct posture. To bring it all together, why is this specific reconstruction carried as our working path? We don't carry it because it's simple.
It's because it remains the only system-level closure path that rigorously respects all of the Tier 1 audit burdens. It mathematically respects the massive energy gap, the impossibly high work of comminution required to powderize the concrete. It respects the bizarre seismic silence of the telemetry and explains the material selectivity and the bounded planar geometry of the destruction footprint.
And our continually updated appendices have only tightened this working model. By adhering strictly to the ionospheric nulls, the complete lack of bulk overhead heating, we were mathematically forced away from generic cartoonish death ray theories and pushed into a rigorous, localized, staged atmospheric bridge model. Furthermore, the geometry module provided a strictly falsifiable map constraint, directly tying the required operational frequencies to the physical, measurable dimensions of the damage on the ground.
Our reconstruction lives precisely within the tight, unforgiving space that the physics has left for us.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the dossier.